We read from that text because we're talking this morning about, you know, the supremacy of Christ, really, and how acceptable a statement that is in our culture today. And so we read from that amazing statement from the letter to the Hebrews. But now we're going back to the very beginning in the book of Genesis. And chapter 12, the call of Abraham to go to a country that's not his own. And we'll talk about what that means for us today. So the call of Abraham, or Abram, in chapter 12 of Genesis, the very beginning of God now reaching out to a specifically focused group of people. And so the Lord said to Abraham, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. He took his wife Sarai and his brother's son Lot and all their possessions that they had gathered, and they went as God had said. This is God's word for us this morning from the book of Genesis. Well, as you look around, and it's not hard to see, the cultural landscape of America is changing. And so, like Abraham and Sarah, we in the church find ourselves increasingly in a land that is not our own. It's a land that seems to already be occupied. It doesn't feel like ours, our place, as it may have at one time. Now, I want to give you some information and statistics here. I know some of these are hard to digest, but also sometimes statistics kind of cut right through and tell us what's going on in our culture. So we're asking, what in the world's going on? These kinds of figures help us understand what in the world is going on. So stay with me here for a minute on this. One of the great researchers on this is a guy named Mark Chavis, and they've done some wonderful work on the religious trends in our nation. And one of them is this, that in the early 70s, 62% of Americans identified with a Protestant church or denomination. That's us. We're Presbyterians and Protestants. In the early 70s, 62% of Americans identified with a Protestant church or denomination. By 2014, fewer than half do. And so for the first time in our history, the United States does not have a Protestant majority. This is a new development. It's a big change. There are other demographic changes in motion as well. The 2020 census, you know, is underway, and we're filling out our information, or some people are calling on the communities. But the census is underway, and when the results are published, it will likely show an increase in non-white Americans. And as many have pointed out, sometime around 2050, we will have a non-white majority in the United States. This is a big change, significant change. And as a result, we are adapting. Some are not adapting as well as others, but we are becoming more and more diverse, and some are growing in their appreciation of this diversity. Listen to this. In the 70s, 16% of married people had a spouse with a different religion. By the 2010s, that increased to 24% of people who are intermarried to someone with a different religion. And intermarriage has led then our extended families to become more diverse and more appreciative of that diversity, led to what some call the Aunt Susan principle. The Aunt Susan principle suggests that if you're a Protestant, for example, but your Aunt Susan is Catholic or Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim or completely non-religious, and you love your Aunt Susan, well, then you grow in appreciation, and it becomes harder to not like or even despise someone who has a different religious take on life. The Aunt Susan principle sort of makes us all a little more appreciative. We all become a little more diverse, and we sort of adapt, and we're okay with it. In Middle America, Muncie, Indiana, the percentage of high school students who agreed with this statement that Christianity is the one true religion and everybody should be converted to it, the percentage of high school students who agreed with that statement dropped from 91% in 1941 to 41% in 1977. That's a cultural shift, friends. And it would, of course, be much lower now. And so today, 3/4 of Americans say yes when asked if they believe there is any religion other than their own that offers a true path to God. 3/4 of Americans. So I just say it again. The cultural and religious landscape is changing quickly and dramatically and has a huge impact on our churches, including ours. Thanks for staying with me on the facts and information part of the sermon this morning. So we ask, why is this? Why all this change? You know, well, books and studies have been made, papers, speeches given on all that. We point to a number of things. You can obviously say that immigration has impacted this change, of course. The ease of international travel has made it easier for people to come and go and to live in other places. And certainly the internet, you know, has really contributed to this. It makes it possible to be exposed to ideas and people with around the world, ideas and people you never would have been exposed to otherwise with the simple click of a mouse or a button, right? And so we have more choices, more options than we have ever had. Some even say that we're in a crisis of choice, that we have so much choice before us. It's a kind of crisis. Listen to this. Here's a little more information for you here. But get this. The amount of digital information. Now, we live in a digital age, so information can now be stored in huge quantities without taking up a lot of space. That's what digital information is. So the amount of digital information created in the last decade was 487 billion gigabytes. Now, that's kind of hard for me to wrap my head around. But that's the equivalent of 4.8 quadrillion bank transactions or 162 trillion digital photos. And that's a lot of information. Maybe it's easier to put it this way. It's estimated that in our time, a person is subjected each and every day to more new information than a person in the Middle Ages is in his or her entire lifetime. More information in a single day than someone in the Middle Ages had in their entire lifetime. That's a lot of information we're called upon to process in our brains. Well, maybe it is a kind of crisis of choice. There really are too many things to choose from. When I was growing up, and I think you too, there were two, maybe three kinds of toothpaste, right? Crest, Colgate, and Pepsodent. We were a Crest family. I always envied my cousins who had Pepsodent. It seemed like it was sweeter and spicier toothpaste. You know? There are three kinds of toothpaste to choose from in those days. Now there are hundreds of kinds of toothpaste. Toothpaste with tartar control, toothpaste with all whitening properties, toothpaste with baking soda, toothpaste without baking soda, toothpaste that has a white paste, toothpaste that comes in a green gel, toothpaste with green gel and sparkles for kids, or white paste and sparkles, toothpaste, cinnamon, peppermint, spearmint, whatever. So many choices. Have you looked to see how many kinds of toothpaste there are on the shelf and how much space that occupies on the shelf? It's amazing. You can say the same thing for cereal and all kinds of other products. So many choices. How do we make up our minds under these conditions? We've become accustomed to it, but how do we do it? And so it's no wonder that the same conditions impact our churches and impact us. I was with some friends recently at a visit over in Seattle just last week, and they were saying that they were enjoying their Sunday morning options during the COVID-19 pandemic. They were kind of enjoying it. There were options on Sunday morning. They would go online and they would check with their home church because they knew me. They'd check in with us. Hi, Doug and Tina, if you're watching this morning. They check with us. They might check with another church. There are all kinds of options for churches on a Sunday morning. And people who are doing this have no problem pushing this button or that button or visiting two or three, maybe four churches within an hour on Sunday morning. That's just the way it is. It's not bad. It's not wrong. It's just what's going on. This is the cultural landscape we're in. And they don't hesitate, people watching from their couches these days, to mute you. And they don't hesitate to push the button and go to another church. The choice is there. They're in control. We're in control when we watch from the couch. Now, one of the drawbacks of that is, as one Methodist bishop, Will Williman, used to say, when we're in control with the remote control, we have no opportunity to be surprised from behind by grace. When you can just push the button, no longer surprised by what might be heard, heard, sung, or prayed. So this is leading many to say that we've moved from a culture of duty to a culture of discretion. When many of us were growing up, we went to church because we had to. You know, our parents took us, and we just went. And it might have been a rewarding experience. It might have been a good experience, but you just went because it was an obligation. Today, people choose to attend worship or not, depending how it fits in with their lives. They have discretion, and they don't bring a sense of duty or obligation to church involvement or to church attendance. If it fits, great. If not, no. And there's no obligation. There's no duty. This is the environment in which we live. You've seen it in your families, and you've seen it in your own community. Trying to describe what in the world is going on. Well, this is part of what in the world is going on. Now, in the letter to the Hebrews, the passage that Gene read, that text proclaims the superiority of Christ, the uniqueness of Christ, who is the exact imprint of God's very being and who sustains all things. It's an astounding thing to say about Christ. And I believe that with all my heart. And most of us here believe that, or something close to it anyway. We see and we experience the supremacy and the superiority of Christ, the centrality of Christ. He is truly to us the reflection of God and the most reliable source and contact with God that we know. So we turn to Jesus. We look to Him. We seek to Him. We seek Him. We pray to Him. We know that we are somehow connected with God when we do that. So He truly is unique. Jesus is central to our lives. We are Christ-centered in our congregation and in our lives. And there's a good reason for it. But our neighbors don't necessarily see it that way. And our co-workers don't really agree with that. Many in our families think that we're too exclusive, not allowing for other paths and other journeys and other ways or other room for other religions and paths to God. And as we've already said, then there are fewer and fewer people in our communities, in our neighborhoods, in our places of work, in our families who see Jesus Christ as the unique Son of God. How do we respond? How do we do this under these conditions? And again, I don't want to say it's bad all the time, because you know it doesn't really do much good for us to somehow sit in judgment on our culture. It just doesn't work. It's not productive. It simply is what's going on in our world. I want us to be good, astute observers of what's taking place. There are certainly things that are not right and not good, but let's watch what's going on. Let's be open to what's going on. And then we'll be better able to understand the opportunities that there are to still quench that deep spiritual thirst that is in our families, that's in our communities, that is in our world. Let's not judge it. Let's see it. Let's see what's going on. So the church, and that means our church, is no longer culturally established. We don't have our place anymore. And so many are saying that the central challenge facing the church today is rediscovering who we are in a society that has in many ways rejected Christianity. We are now asking what it means to be a church in a culture that is increasingly hostile or indifferent to the faith that we hold so dearly. So how do we respond? What do we do under these conditions? You know, and I'm trying to be careful here. I don't want to paint a picture of gloom and doom, but we are trying to describe what's happening, and this is part of it. But how do we respond? What do we do? And let's say first this, that what's taking place in our church over the last several years, you know, fewer and fewer children, declining attendance, these kinds of trends, these kinds of things going on, it's not necessarily our fault. Sure, there are things we could do to improve and do better to reach the community, no question about it. But the cultural changes we're discussing this morning are deep and profound, and in many ways they're simply beyond our control. So I hope you hear the grace in that. It's not our fault, friends. You all have been good, faithful members and contributors to this congregation and church for years. What's happening is not your fault. God bless you for being faithful, but things are way beyond our control. What in the world is going on is way beyond our control. But it also means, because it's on beyond our control, that we can't apply a sort of simple fix to the problem. We have to adapt to the real changes taking place. We can't just fix it by having, you know, more children, more young families, that kind of thing. We can't go back to the way it used to be, because that is long gone. So we can't just fix it. We have to adapt to the changes taking place. This new cultural situation, it's here to stay. Let's put it this way. Many have described it this way. If I were to break my ankle, I would go to a doctor, and the doctor would repair the break, put me in a cast, send me home, and I would go back a few weeks or months later and get the cast removed, and I would then carry on, and eventually I would be back to normal as if the break never happened, of course, depending on how bad the break was, but I would be able to get that break fixed, repaired, and get on with my life just as if it had never happened before. However, and that's a technical fix. Now, on the other hand, however, if I have an allergy or something, say to, I don't know, grasses, which I sort of do, and if I have an allergy to hay or alfalfa, well, that makes Baker not a great place to live, I suppose, yeah. But if I have an allergy to hay or alfalfa or something like that, that's something that can't really be fixed. That's a more like a chronic condition, and I have to adapt to the situation. I can't just fix it. I've got to live with it and learn, find ways to live with it. I have to do the adapting to what is now a condition that just doesn't go away. So what we're saying is that the new conditions of our culture and its relationship to the church and to the Christian faith, we're in a kind of chronic, we're living with a kind of chronic condition. It simply can't be fixed, what's happening in our world, by having, you know, younger families or younger people or new people or a new, fresh, young pastor. It's nice, but it just can't be fixed right now. This is the hard news. We can't just turn it around. It's not that simple. We're in a time that demands adaptive change on our part. We're the ones that need to do the turning around. And as someone said, until we accept that this situation is not a turnaround situation, it cannot be addressed as a move ahead situation. I hope you understand what I'm saying here. All kinds of ways I suppose I could be misinterpreted this morning. And as we met in our mission study last Sunday, I was perhaps more honest than I need to be. Though I think that's important too, but I'm trying to state it as I understand it, folks. Because when we understand it, and when we see what the true case is, when we see what the true condition is, then we can start moving ahead. And I firmly believe, and I believe this with all my heart, that you all, we all, are in a position to really dream about the future. So don't miss that part of this. We're in a position to really dream about the future, but let's get the diagnosis correct before we move ahead. Is that good? Is that all right? Let's understand what's going on, and then we move ahead. So that's what I mean when we say, we're not just, until we see that this is not just a sort of regular turnaround situation, it won't be a move ahead situation. We want to be in a move ahead situation to what people call, you know, a new normal. It's because we're not going back to the old normal. As Dorothy says in The Wizard of Oz, Toto, I've got a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore, right? That's how profound the change in our cultural climate is. Now, let's not lose hope. I don't feel hopeless. I see opportunity for us. And I don't want you to feel hopeless. When God called Abraham, he commanded Abraham to leave his country, and Abraham and Sarah to leave their country and go to a land that was not his. In the same way, we find ourselves in a land, a society and culture that is not entirely our own anymore. We are kind of like Abraham and Sarah. Yet God promises that Abraham will become a great nation. And what does that mean for us? Well, maybe it means that we'll be more than we had ever imagined. We will be more, perhaps, as a church, both as a congregation and as a larger church, more than we ever could have imagined under other circumstances. We are to be a blessing to others. That's the focus. The focus is not how we can get more people into our church or more children into our programs, good as these things are, but to be a blessing to our community in the way that, for example, Backpacks Ministry and Open Door Ministry have been, and to be a simple presence in the community that has blessed Baker City. And I think, by the way, that we can do both things. We can do good a presence in the community and good outreach and be a blessing to our community and also have internal growth ourselves. Both things can go on at the same time. It's not an either or. We talked a little bit about that last Sunday too. So what's the picture? What's the image there now that we carry with us? Who are we? What is our identity? Well, like Abraham and Sarah, we're now nomads. We're the adventurers. We're the pioneers now. We're not the settled ones anymore. For decades after World War II, we were the settled ones, the Presbyterian Church in Baker City and any other town or city in the nation. We're not the settled ones anymore. We are the pioneers. That takes a whole new mindset, but that's who we are. We're now the pioneers. We're Oregon Trail pioneers, friends. Finding our way to a new land, we're invited to leave what is familiar, our kindred, as Abraham did, our fathers and mothers. This is no longer our fathers and mother's church, as the ad says, right? This isn't our father and mother's church anymore. And we have to leave that behind and seek what a new church will look like. Again, I think we're in a position to dream about that. To see what the church will look like in the years and decades ahead. It will continue to be disorienting and uncomfortable. That's what living in a new land is. So if you feel the disorientation and the uncomfortableness of our situation as a church in these days, well, that's kind of the way it's supposed to feel. That's what being dislodged feels like. The cultural supports for the church are no longer there. The cultural props aren't there anymore. The cultural affirmations aren't there anymore. When we go to our meetings in the community, they rarely, I don't know entirely about Baker, but they don't open in prayer as they might have before, Rotary, Lions, you know, the other groups. They may, I don't know, but that's happening less and less, I'm sure of that. So the cultural support for what happens here isn't found in the community anymore. Fewer and fewer of our schools open with prayer or the Pledge of Allegiance. One nation under God isn't spoken as it used to be. Now again, we can sit and judge that, okay, but let's just take note of it as much as anything. And try to find our way under these new conditions. That's what we're trying to say this morning. Because the cultural supports, if you're with me here, I think... If you understand what I'm saying, they're just not propping us up like they used to. We don't find the same affirmation outside those doors as we used to. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's what we're involved with here. So we're not the settled ones anymore. We're pioneers, and it's going to continue to feel a little discomforting and a little disorient, and there's going to be some disorientation. But in doing this, we see the spiritual thirst in the people around us, in our communities, in our families. in our culture. Last week we talked about secularism, you know, and we said, well, one of the trends is that there's a worldview, secularism, that suggests that we are entirely without God, you know, that it's left to us. We're left to our own devices. But it turns out that we're not as secular as we like to think we are. There is always, and there will always remain, I'm convinced of this, John Calvin, one of our forefathers, was fond of saying that there is a seed of religion in everyone. And I think that's true. There is something in everyone. There is divine DNA in every human being. It's the breath of God. And, you know, just the key is to become aware of it. There is this, but everyone that you meet has this thirst. I'm certain of it. May not be aware of the thirst, but the spiritual thirst is deep and profound in our time. We just need to be able to see it, understand it, and how to connect with it. And we see this thirst, you know, in our movies, our television shows, this spiritual hunger. We see it on the internet. And we're in a position to be in conversation with people in our community and our families and places of work, not to force the message upon them. That doesn't work, does it? And I think you all are just really great examples of this. You're just so good at sharing who you are and your faith in real natural ways. We don't force religion upon people, but we invite them to be part of something more, the more that they are searching for, the more that we are all searching for. It really is no us and them. We are all searching for something more, aren't we? Some have begun to find it. Others are just lost. So not to force it, but to invite. Now, we can invite them here, certainly, but we can also invite them out there to other kinds of gatherings and events and relationships to quench this thirst. Invite them to drink from the well. I read somewhere that there's an old tradition, maybe that's true in Eastern Oregon, I don't know too, but among Australian ranches that are often located on very dry land, that there are two ways of keeping cattle on the ranch. One way is to build a fence. The other way is to dig a well. So we're now in a time when building fences around our tribe, our church, or our religious position will not work. There is no longer an us or them, an in or out, or a this side of the fence or that side of the fence. Instead, we want to invite all people to taste the life giving water of Jesus, who offers all of us a spring of water, as he tells the woman at the well in the Gospel of John, a spring of water gushing up within us, gushing up to eternal life. That all people experience as they begin to fall in step with Jesus. That begins to change life and begins to quench that thirst. There are, it seems, that in this day there are many paths and journeys these days. But the way to the water of life is still found in Jesus, the one who offers us this well, and still found on the journey with Jesus. May that be your experience, and may you drink deeply from that well in the days ahead, in the week ahead. And when you feel like the right time to invite, say to someone else that they might consider drinking from that well too. Amen.